welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director F.W. Murnau and his 1927 film, Sunrise. Returning on the show today to talk about Sunrise, Professor Mike Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So, for this film is really, this is the second time I've watched it. This is the first time I've seen it in like 3-4 years. And always, it still surprises me how experimental and like creative this film is. Where, you know, with the camera movement and the sets. I mean, if you've seen Murnau's other films, he kind of always has that experimental side. It's really impressive, and this is what really stuck out to me the second time.
Well, what impresses you is what impressed Hollywood studio executives in the mid 1920s. Murnau was one of the leading German film directors. And Germany, arguably, was as strong a film industry as Hollywood in several respects. In terms of the actual studio facilities, just as Hollywood prided itself by the mid-20s on having really, really big stages and technical equipment, everything you could want, in other words. You know, you go to MGM, you go to Paramount, and any of the big studios, and you've got the big stage, which of course would become a sound stage within a few years. You've got the stages, you got the equipment, you can create the world under the roof, right? You can do everything indoors like that. And Hollywood loved to do that, or occasionally go to the back lot if you had to. German studios, or the main German studio in Berlin, actually was not only similar, but I would say even more advanced. And in terms of what you're talking about by way of the experimental quality, a lot of that is an issue really of technical virtuosity, what you can do with the camera, editing, etc. And the German film industry was, I would say, actually ahead of Hollywood at that point in terms of camera mobility and what you could do within a studio. And Murnau, of course, had made really remarkable films, real masterpieces, like Nosferatu in 1922, which for my money is still the greatest vampire movie, and The Last Laugh in 1924 and so on. And the point I'm trying to make here is that people in Hollywood saw those films. Indeed, those films were released in the United States and did well commercially. And they understand money, and they thought, you know, we need to learn from this. And one way they learned from it was to actually bring over a good bit of the film talent. Mm-hmm. And so directors like Murnau actually were invited. In this case, it was William Fox, who invited Murnau to come over. And you know what he did? He actually said to Murnau, you have carte blanche. You can do whatever you want with the film that became Sunrise. Very few directors, period, had that kind of creative power.
Especially not today.
Oh, well, yeah, very few people. And yet Murnau was such a star director that William Fox, in effect, said, you know, it's yours. You do what you want here. And so, again, when you mention experimental, it's that Murnau was able to do exactly what he wanted with the film. There was reportedly some tinkering with things like subtitles in post-production because Murnau had moved on to another project. But while he was making the film, he did exactly what he wanted. And so William Fox, you know, in effect had kind of like low-budget, cheap things like Tom Mix Westerns to make money and took some of the profits from those blatantly commercial films and plowed them into Sunrise, which was an expensive film to produce. And so what you see there is really kind of heartening in that you had a major studio head, you know, William Fox. He's the same guy who would become 20th Century Fox later. This is when he was still William Fox, because 20th Century Fox didn't form until 1935, so William Fox is on his own at this point. But anyway, making a big budget film and wanting it to be a commercial success, you've got that production value, but also wanting it to be an aesthetic success. You know, you want prestige as well, and he got the prestige that he was looking for here for sure.
Yeah, and I believe you just see it in the sets; they're very elaborate. Like the main thing when they go to the big town area where they go to dance and they get the pictures. I believe that set costs like $300,000.
It was an immense budget, and you know, if you factor in inflation, it's like really, really, it's creating a world again indoors for the most part. But it's more complicated than that in the sense that this is very much an indoors outdoors kind of storyline. In Sunrise, you will have a peasant couple, you know, living out in the countryside, but the man will go to town, literally. And when he goes to town, things are really, really contrasted in a fascinating way. because the countryside is treated in a really kind of dreamy way that harkens back to German romantic painting and poetry of the 19th century. Painters like Caspar David Friedrich, very moody, very sensual, very kind of low-lit and murky cinematography at times to give a sense of an almost dreamscape kind of landscape. Some of that was actually shot outdoors at Lake Arrowhead, which is about 100 miles from L.A. Some of those scenes, though, were actually shot in the studio, creating a dreamy landscape. For instance, there's a scene set in the marsh where if you look, you can tell that the moon is painted on a back wall. So it mixes like real outdoors footage with studio creations. But again, the contrast I was getting at is you have German Romanticism effectively being evoked in the landscapes, whether actual outdoors or simulated outdoors. And then once you get to town, it's very different because that rural architecture, like farmhouses and so on, is right out of the Brothers Grimm. I mean, it's fairy tale architecture, yeah. Medieval slash fairy tale. Whereas when you get to town, the buildings, and this is what you're referring to with the constructed set, are Bauhaus inspired. And that's where the influence is not so much German Romanticism, it's more German Expressionism. Which certainly was the most notable stylistic trait from those German films of the 20s. Though many of those actually combined elements of Romanticism and Expressionism. It gets kind of complicated. But once you're in town, it's a very modern look that the place has. And everything is built under the studio roof on the stage, as I said earlier. And what Murnau does there to make the city seem even bigger than what you could actually construct on a stage is there's a lot of forced perspective. Very similar, actually, to what Fritz Lang would do in Metropolis in 1927, forced perspective to make things look deeper and taller than they actually were. And it goes even further than that in that he hired a number of what they would have called midgets. I'll call them vertically challenged actors, you know, short actors that way, and children, and some of them dressed as characters or extras that were not meant to be children. Why to do that? Well, so that in the foreground you'd have very short performers, and then in the background, you know, you could have taller people. And so, in other words, if you sort of like mix and match there as to where you want to place your performers, you can play with pictorial depth as to whether you make a shot look, you know, shallow or deep. It depends on, well, where to put the tall actor, where to put the short actor. But he would do things like that in crowd scenes, depending on the effect he wanted. So that's how carefully orchestrated, how carefully choreographed it is. So it's not just the constructed architecture, it's the human beings, many of them just extras and crowd scenes, but as to the effect he wanted in terms of how deep or how shallow to make the space seem. And he really was literally doing that. He was hiring, like, you know, relatively tall people and relatively short people. I know, it's so funny, and wow. like moving them around that way. I mean, the obsessive concern there, you know what I mean? It's not just hiring me 100 extras, it's like, well, how tall is he? Yeah.
Yeah, and once again, that's just like sort of a perfect example of German Expressionism. Like, even remember early on when it's one of the scenes where in the farmhouse, even the farmhouse, the angle of the house is distorted. And watching that immediately brings to mind the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, where everything in that house is always just all that buildings in that movie is distorted or at a weird angle.
Well, exactly. And that film came out in 1919 and it was extremely influential, obviously, in the German film industry, but also here. I mean, Americans saw that and were influenced by it. And it's everything we were just talking about in terms of buildings that structurally should not stand.
Yeah.
I mean, the walls are at odd angles and looming, and the streets are narrow and threatening and run at crazy diagonal angles and so on. And again, in terms of casting human beings, in Caligari, much of the action, such as it is, takes place at the fairgrounds, and you have carnival crowds, as they call them. You have not only sideshow attractions, but the people on the street are kind of like sideshow attractions. Because you have, like, he does, like, really does use, what they would have called midgets back then. This is, I guess, somehow, like, these were maybe like the older brothers and sisters, like for The Wizard of Oz or something. You know, it's like, like, you know, you have that cast, and then you'd have actual children and so on. You could say, well, that's folks you might find at the fairgrounds. But again, in visually conceptualizing it in terms of where to place them in the frame, you can can again make the street seem, you know, really shallow or really deep, depending on where you place those variously heighted people. It's a really kind of weird thing. We don't think of casting that way typically, do we?
But no, not at all.
No, but this is where the director is the master of the universe, and he says, "Yes, I want you as an actor because you're only 5 feet high." You know, I mean, yeah, that would please me if I were 5 foot tall. If I were like 5 foot four, I'd be turned away and rejected.
And not only is he bringing in, like you said, German expressionism, but I think there's also a lot of American influence here because there is quite a bit of kind of goofy slapstick comedy. One of the two things I remember is when they knock over the statue, but they don't realize that they thought they broke it, but they realize there's purposely no head or arm, so they put on like this little goofy plush doll thing on for the head. And then the other scene, it keeps going back with the recurring joke with this woman's side of the dress keeps falling down. The guy keeps bringing it up, and then he gets so tired of it because it keeps happening. So he just like brings them both down. The woman slaps him in the face. Like, that's a lot of stuff that seems like something out of like a Keaton or a Chaplin film.
It's a great observation because the film, in so many ways, is improbable, and yet it works perfectly. In other words, ordinarily you would not expect a film to have both German Romanticism and German Expressionism. I mean, visually those are, on the face of it, very different things. And yet in a number of German films in the 20s, as I said earlier, you get both of those operating. You really get them operating simultaneously here, at least as you go from country to city. But correspondingly, and playing off of what you just mentioned, in terms of the performance style, these are deliberately generic characters. I mean, the peasant couple, the husband and wife, are given actual names, but they don't really have what a conventional Hollywood screenwriter would call a backstory to any great degree. Mm-hmm. You don't really get them they are deliberately generic, or let's say archetypal, because the whole thing's like a fairy tale, isn't it?
Very fairy
tale. And then when the husband and wife will have the marriage endangered because the husband's going to have an affair, the woman he has the affair with doesn't even really get a given name. She's just the woman from the city.
The city woman.
Which I could imagine in like a marital argument, like you're with that woman from the city. But in terms of, again, improbable elements, what I'm getting at the moment is that much of the story is really so serious, so somber, so heartbreaking, and yet simultaneously it has moments of near slapstick, which is what you're referring to. And you're absolutely right. And I can't logically explain why all those elements are not only in the same film, but somehow that they work, and yet they do. And that's the important thing, that sometimes great art is not immediately or readily explainable. Mm-hmm. And I think in Sunrise, he somehow takes all these elements and improbably makes them not only work together, but that the film seems cohesive. It doesn't seem, I mean, as we talk about it, it seems disjointed. It seems like it's at odds with itself. But as you watch it, it actually does have a kind of organic merit to it. It seems like everything should go together, or somehow does go together. And that almost gets beyond, you know, verbal explanation as to why it works. If it works, it works.
Yeah, I agree, because it is, the whole story is that it's them like sort of finding, rekindling their love, and that the way they do that is through this trip through the city, and all sorts of crazy fun things happen, like, you know, the pig goes loose, he has to find the pig, they go dancing, they take the picture, and you said it's like a fairy tale. I think one of the things people might have a complaint about is that the story is too unrealistic, because at the beginning of the film he's planning to murder his wife so he can be with the woman from the city, and so the wife figures it out, but he can't do it. But then, like, in the matter of just, like, a couple hours, she immediately forgives him. And I think a lot of people would be like, I wouldn't be that forgiving of my significant other. They tried to murder me.
Well, but again, one of the archetypal elements here is that the wife loves him so much, mm-hmm, that she's willing to forgive his transgressions. And I'm trying to think how best to phrase this, in that nowadays I think we'd be much more likely to say, well, she should just go to divorce court, you know, or she should take up with a man or whatever. In other words, the mindset, the value system may not exactly correspond with ours today. In this case, part of that archetypal love is that she's so devoted to him that when he sins, when he fails, when he falls short, when he's with a woman from the city, of course she's crushed by that, she's hurt by that, but that her love will overcome that. And eventually it does. I mean, that's one of the really heartbreaking aspects of the film, is that, you know, how much he's damaged that marriage, and yet not all marriages will end in divorce. Some will end or lead to a kind of reconciliation, you know, having gone through all that suffering, that they can hold on to the love that they had. And there's no reason why that isn't a plausible emotional scenario. It's just in films nowadays, we're I would argue, probably less likely to go for that. And it may simply be because in terms of gender relations that, you know, he's the one who has offended. He's the sinner. He's the weak man and so on. And we're more inclined nowadays to say, well, you know, she should leave him, or she should, you know, find a man of her own. Like if he can find a woman from the city, she should be able to find a man from the city or something.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Definitely.
And I don't want to get sidetracked with that discussion, because, you know, you can think of valid reasons in terms of gender equity that we would make that case. But for a film like this, it's a somewhat different I'd say ethical scenario in terms of the values that they have, they express. And to quickly double back on a point you made earlier, when you mentioned how American it is in some ways, one reason why this film to me seems like a curious fusion of the European and the American is, even though so many of the design influences, German Romanticism, German Expressionism, these are European things. And indeed, the characters themselves are dressed like European characters more than American. It's mm-hmm. more of a European fairy tale. Concurrently, and again, improbable elements together, the essential core of it in terms of value system and character, to the extent that there's character, is that you have what we typically call rural integrity and urban corruption.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great, great motifs in American literature and goodness knows in Hollywood movies, not only in the 19-teens and 20s in particular, but well into the 1930s, and beyond. I mean, think, you know, like Frank Capra's Mr. Deeds Goes to Town or something. I mean, you have, you know, that playing out over and over and over again. It still plays out in movies today. In fact, it's such an underpinning of American thought that if I say, as I just did, you know, rural integrity and urban corruption, a lot of us just sort of nod like, well, yeah, that's how it is. That's the way it plays out. But what if I, for the sake of argument, flipped it and talked about rural corruption and urban integrity? You know, people look at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Like, no, it doesn't go
like
that way. It doesn't work that way. No. You know, the big city is Sodom and Gomorrah, mm-hmm. and the bucolic paradise is out there in the sticks. And you can fill in the blank at that point in terms of, oh, well, let's say a presidential election or something as to how this plays out in American politics and in a larger framework, American culture. But putting all that aside to the extent that I can, is just that one reason why this movie has a kind of archetypal pull, a kind of fairy tale quality, is that it taps directly into that. And I'm not saying that's distinctively American, because after all, it's a very European film in some ways. But in America, particularly in the 20s, as we were going from being a rural economy to an urban economy, that was the decade more than any other in which people left the farm, went to the city. And I don't want to overstate it, but in terms of our mindset, the 1920s was a very modern decade, a very urban decade in a lot of ways, and people were starting to leave the farm, and they were thinking about, not that they hadn't been leaving it earlier, but they're really thinking about what's involved when you go from the country to the city. And this mm-hmm. is a story that, as a fairy tale, is a kind of cautionary tale. And it's the ideological underpinnings of it are that, you know, it's not for nothing that vampish character, that seductress, is called, you know, the woman from the city. I mean, mm-hmm. you might as well italicize the words. You know, she's a vamp. She's after you.
And even in her appearance, she's dressed a lot like the flappers from the 1920s. You know, and she's even dancing, doing the Charleston a little bit. Like, you know, this is definitely representing like the jazz age.
She is a very modern woman, and in the world of the film, that's not something positive.
No.
Because the film has a more traditional ethos there in terms of, you know, the peasants in the countryside, the good life they had, the good marriage they had, and she's the corrupter. And in fact, while we're mentioning that woman from the city, the actress playing her is Margaret Livingston. She had a career in the teens, 20s, and 30s, usually playing seductive roles. I want to give you actually just a few of the film titles that she was in. This will let you know, you know, the quality she brought as an actor to it and why they cast her in it. A movie called Alimony from 1917. I know, I love the titles. What's Your Husband Doing? A film from 1920. Divorce, a film from 1923. Wandering Husbands, a film from 1924. And Say It with Sables from 1928. And then she did work a little bit into the sound era. And in 1932, a movie called Call Her Savage. Now, if you have that filmography as an actress, you are born to play the woman from the city. The other quick footnote, and this is a trivia note here, she's also notable for her marriage to the band leader Paul Whiteman. Paul Whiteman was one of the biggest musical names in America in the 20s, and a bit beyond. And, you know, when you think of George Gershwin and so on, I mean, you think about the Paul Whiteman band. So she actually would have been fairly well known. And so it really is that when I say central casting here, it's like if you need a vamp, you need someone who to seduce the guy from the country. Margaret Livingston, I mean, she's all set to go. You know, she just put her, and she's really good at doing that. It's sometimes it's borderline caricature, but you know what? The whole film is borderline that way because sometimes some of the acting is really broad acting, really big archetypal gestures, but it also has remarkably subtle moments. Again, these improbable elements. How could a performance be so broad in some places, but so subtle, so subdued in others? And somehow these performances are both.
Yeah, and even contrast her performance, I'd say, with Janet Gaynor, who plays, you know, the wife. You know, she's very, you know, once again, she plays that, like, where that one's a vamp. She's, like, as pure as white snow. She's angelic in any way. And talking to you and connecting to earlier film, she was in A Star Is Born, the very first one, in which now we're getting, like, the fifth version. But her career was pretty short, though.
Well, yes and no. She had done bit parts in the mid-1920s and then suddenly became a movie star with the film we're talking about, Sunrise. Also, a film called Seventh Heaven, made the same year, 1927, a big hit, and Street Angel, 1928. She hit all at once in that respect. And then she continued making successful films into the 30s, including, as you mentioned, that first version of Star Is Born from 1937. You're right in the sense that she was never a major star after that, but she kept working in film, theater, radio, television. She crossed from medium to medium. Hmm. She even appeared in a 1980 episode of the TV series The Love Boat. So yeah, I know. Isn't that something? In fact, if you watch, I'm not recommending people watch The Love Boat, but if you were to have it on, how often some of the old stars who were still kicking at that point, they'd show up, that their agent said, this is the best I could get you, or at that point they're hungry, just be on camera. Mm-hmm. But like people who went back to like the 20s and 30s would end up on The Love Boat. Yeah, I know. Ain't America great?
Yeah, and then we also could talk about it, the main actor, the husband, is George O'Brien. I think I best know him for his stuff he did with John Ford. I know he was in Ford Apache, and then I forget the other one. I can't remember the name.
He has those macho man credentials.
And yeah, she wore a yellow ribbon.
And to take him back to his earlier career, he had been a heavyweight boxer. He didn't just have an athletic build. He was a boxer, mm-hmm. heavyweight no less, right? And then he became a movie star in the early 1920s by playing physically rugged roles in Westerns. And that's why John Ford would have him on his roster of people he wanted to work with. Indeed, back in that period, mid-20s, the studio publicity machine nicknamed him the Chest. I usually might think like stereotypically like you'd have some starlet, right? Some female that would be called that or something close to that, right? But this is a male actor, right? And he was sort of the Victor Mature type thing, right? He was called the Chest. Murnau wanted him because he had those macho man qualities. And he accentuated O'Brien's already solid physical presence by having the actor wear lead weights in his shoes to make his character in Sunrise seem even more weighed down by his moral dilemma. And it's very similar almost to what they did with Boris Karloff in Frankenstein, where they put lead weights in the shoes, so he has that lumbering walk, that slow halting. And because it's quasi-zombie at times, for this character in Sunrise, this man is a simple man. I don't say that in a condescending way. He's a very simple man. And he's weak enough that he's seduced by the vamp from the city. And then that's, goodness knows, weighing on his conscience because his wife is such a good woman, what he's done to her, how he's hurt her, and so on. And so as he's wandering around, he seems like he's in a daze or almost in a zombie-like way. And then connecting this back to the German film industry, it's eerily reminiscent of the golem figures walking in zombie-like fashion in German Expressionist films. Think about mm-hmm. Cesare the Somnambulist in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Think about some other, actually, films called The Golem in the teens. Yeah, various versions of that. And they walk in that kind of, you know, pre-George Romero, way of
slow,
very slow. These are slow zombies. They have that lumbering kind of walk. But that again, that's one reason why it's such a stylized performance. And sometimes it strikes us now as being maybe overstated, or you know, like people don't walk that way, whatever. Well, of course they don't. But you know, this is not quote unquote realism. This is a mm-hmm. different approach to character and storyline in a lot of ways.
I think that's one of the big things people like talk about when they talk about silent movies today. When people like are new to it, they always say, why is the acting so over the top? And I don't think, you know, not just this film, a lot of silent films weren't necessarily trying to be 100% realistic, and it was just more of showing as much emotion as possible.
There are at least two major reasons for what you're getting at. Number one is so much of early cinema comes directly out of theater in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, when melodrama was the most popular genre. And in melodramatic acting, particularly stage acting, you're going to make the big gesture, not just because you're playing an overhyped character who's got a lot going on and is acting out and so on, but very pragmatically because you need to wave your arms so that people up in the balcony can see what you're doing. And even very great actors of that era, Sarah Bernhardt most famously, late in her career, 1912, she made a movie, Queen Elizabeth, which was an important film d'or, an important art film, if you will. And it has her stage performance captured on cinema. She's terrible in the film because she has no idea of how to modulate or play it smaller for the camera. She's waving her arms and plays it big. It's a film theater performance, essentially, and she's playing it like she would on stage. But meantime, the camera's 10 feet away, and you think, what's her problem, you know, waving her arms? Like, and it's sad in some ways because, again, it's that transitional period where she wasn't, and how could she be fully aware of how to modulate for the camera and so on? But that's certainly one reason, is you have people coming from the world of theater. And the audience, in other words, for those movies would not be struck in a pejorative sense as we are, like that somehow it's overstated, exaggerated. Think, well, no, I mean, they paid their money to see a good melodrama, and the actors are acting out the way you'd expect in a melodrama. Though even there, I hasten to say there's some very subtle moments on occasion, even amidst some of the arm waving. The second reason, of course, is that in silent films, for obvious reasons, you're acting with your whole body.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of physicalized performance. And in a movie like Sunrise, I don't think it's a problem whatsoever at all. Even when the woman from the city is making these, you know, vampish poses and moving that way, slinking around, I think, well, you know, we have this kind of kitchen sink realism that we assume is good acting, and then we have method acting to reinforce that by way of realistic standards. But by that standard, would we say that kabuki is bad acting? Because right. they wave their arms and they shout and, you know, in a high-pitched voice or something. You know, that again, it's a matter of culturally there are different kinds of acting. And within our own culture, we've had different styles of acting. But nowadays, because that kind of realism is so entrenched, we assume everything else somehow falls short of it.
Yeah, it's bad.
It's bad. Yeah. It's different, so it's bad.
And we were talking about transition. This was 1927, this was like almost like a peak year. Late 20s were almost like a peak time for silent movies, because at the same year you had Metropolis, and I believe the same year or a year later you had The Passion of Joan of Arc, but this same year also you had The Jazz Singer, which brought in the sound era. And it's like, I know you were talking when we discussed earlier on the email, you said like this was kind of the silent movies were hitting their peak, but right as they hit the peak, the sound era came in, and that sort of just killed the silent era.
Yeah, the important thing to remember is that this film, Sunrise, came out 1 month after The Jazz Singer. And a lot of people somewhat mistakenly think, well, The Jazz Singer, you know, was the first feature with sound, and suddenly the silent era ended. It was more gradual than that. There were short films made as early as 1926 that had sound, at least sound on disc initially, to accompany the images. And a lot of people who either haven't seen The Jazz Singer or haven't seen it in a long time tend to forget, frankly, that it's a part talkie. Much of The Jazz Singer is actually silent or has some synchronized sounds, and there are only a few really all-talking sequences in it. So when this film comes out in 1927, it went into production as a silent film, but as it's being released, sound is starting to come in. The transition to sound wasn't really completed till 1929, and you get a kind of weird Twilight Zone period in 27, 28, when you have some movies that are still silent, you have some movies that are part talkies, and then you have some that are they're, you know, all talkies. That's why when you watch some of the films from 1929, right in the credits, they'll say, you know, all talking, all singing, all dancing. You know, we're finally
Garbo
here.
Talks.
Yeah. Well, anybody talks at this point. You know, you have that. One indication of how it was a transitional picture was that the film score by Hugo Riesenfeld, which is a really good score, was actually synchronized, as were the sound effects. And what they did was they used the Fox movie tone process that placed the orchestral soundtrack along the side of the film frame. this is getting into what we take for granted with sound on film, that it runs down the side of the strip there. So it's no longer a Vitaphone type process of having, you know, the music on discs that are coordinated with the image. No, this is the sound on film. So there is no dialogue in this film, but the music you hear, the sound effects, those are synchronized with the visuals. Now, this movie tone version of Sunrise was presented in big cities whose theaters had already been wired for sound. See, one reason why it was a gradual transition wasn't that the technology wasn't there. It was more a matter, in a business sense, of implementation. You had to take thousands, tens of thousands of movie theaters and get them wired for sound. You don't just do that in a weekend, you know. A lot goes into that. But what happened was the big cities then got that synchronized sound version, but the studio also released a visually identical silent version for smaller theaters out in the provinces. So speaking of town and gown, speaking of country versus the city, depending on where you were, how you heard it. But as the film went into production, even then, you know, they knew about sound films because of these short films from 1926 into 27. And they worried about that. And then what happened was, ironically, and back to your original point, 1927 is just about the peak year for the silent cinema, just as it's the same year for the jazz singer with, you know, a huge commercial hit because it has sound. And the really sad thing about it is, creatively, aesthetically, the silent film was at its peak just before it ended. And the people involved at the time were not naive on this score, and you know, speaking of scores, and they knew how much was being lost at that point. Let me very quickly mention Murnau's awareness of that. He died in a car accident in 1931, just a matter of weeks or months before he died, young like that, I think he was 42, just before his death, he wrote a letter to somebody, and he observed, quote, "The talking picture represents a great step forward in the cinema. Unfortunately, it has come too soon. We had just begun to find our way with the silent film, and we're beginning to exploit all the possibilities of the camera. And now here are the talkies, and the camera is forgotten while people rack their brains about how to use the microphone," close quote. And speaking into a microphone at the moment, I realized that, you know, now for us that's relatively easy, but it was really difficult in the early sound films to get the right levels, to have everything record properly. And what would happen is, aesthetically, a kind of reversion. In the German film industry in the mid to late 1920s, in the American film industry for that matter, they were finding ways to have a more mobile camera, to move the camera, and beautifully tracked shots, and simultaneously to have fewer intertitles, title cards, because you could tell the story visually. This film, The Last Laugh, only has one title card. This film, Sunrise, has a few, though reportedly most of those resulted post-production when Murnau had left to make another film and the studio got nervous about not having title cards and they added a few. Now, it's hard to prove definitively what happened there, but I tend to favor that interpretation that Murnau was trying to get as few title cards as possible. The studio was looking to put at least a few in. You don't really need the ones that are even there, but they were kind of insecure about that and they added them. And then what happens then as sound films become dominant by 1929, because of the problems with the recording technology and the tinny sound and microphones not being omnidirectional and so on, there was a kind of aesthetic reversion, and you ended up with film theater. Yeah. You end up with actors standing on stage talking at close quarters because the microphone boom is right overhead. And the camera is set in cement at that point. You know what I mean? There's very little. And it's really only in the early 1930s. There are some exceptions to that. But for the most part, you have to go into the early 30s before the camera learns how to move again or extensively move again.
Even think of that scene in Singing in the Rain when they're having problems of, like, speaking into the mic in the right place, and when they do the test screening, it's terrible. It's all over the place, and they can't get their right recording.
Well, Jean Crane's immortal performance as Lena Lamont, where you know, first of all, you know, she was a great silent star, and she wasn't a great actor ever, but she was a great silent star, opposite Don Lockwood, the Gene Kelly character. And then when sound is coming in, They say, well, what are we going to do about Lena? You know, because she's got to talk, and of course she's got this high screeching, you know, voice with, you know, the thickest Brooklyn accent and so on, and she's awful. But also just at the technological level, how can they get her recorded? So they have to hide the microphone. It's a very funny sequence as a montage there. You can put the microphone in her corsage. You can put it here. You can put it there. But then of course it's only going to pick up sound in a closely defined area, so she doesn't know any better, and she's turning her head this way and that, and it picks up every other word. Mm-hmm. And most people know that sequence. It's such a famous sequence there. But that actually, in a very humorous way, captures the really serious problems they had with trying to get sound on film.
Yeah, and I want to go back a little bit to what you talked about with mobile camera movement. I mean, this movie has, especially in his earlier film, The Last Laugh, a lot of really incredible like long takes. Like, I'm thinking of specifically one scene when he's first meeting the woman from the city, and it follows him going from his house and the farm all the way down to the pond area. And it's especially at this time when you don't really think of a lot of mobile cameras. Like, that's pretty incredible long take.
You know, you're absolutely right. Another example in the film, which I think is just mesmerizing, a streetcar going into the city, where it's a combination of a long take, you know, with very few breaks, but, you know, keeping the camera there with the actor and as you move from country to city. But also the fact that, you know, if you're on a streetcar like that, even with a stationary camera, everything you see through the window. So the long and short of it there is that you can go for minutes at a time with what is either an unbroken take or nearly an unbroken take in terms of what you're showing there. Very few filmmakers have the creative smarts and the planning skills to bring that off. Going back to the German studio model, if you read about the German film industry in Babelsberg, what they could do in the studio, and you look at the huge stages they had, you know, Fritz Lang could build that modern city in Metropolis right there. And then when you realize how elaborate the tracking shots were, if you look at production stills, you know, photographs taken on the set that way, and you think that's like a network of railroad tracks, mm-hmm. you know, around the stage, and it's not just at ground level, but for the elevated tracking shots. You can also place, you know, the equivalent of railroad tracks on the ceiling too, right? Not just the floor. And then you can have the camera move in like that. That really impressed Hollywood studio talent. That's why they were bringing over, you know, Murnau was only in Hollywood for a bit, but people who stayed here, you know, like Fritz Lang and so on, some of them came over because they were invited in the 20s. Others came over in the early 30s because they were fleeing Hitler. But however they got here, you have directors like Fritz Lang and Billy Wilder, who began mm-hmm. in the German film industry and then became leading directors in Hollywood. But it was for their technical savvy as much as anything that Hollywood was interested.
Yeah, and especially because we could talk a bit more about Murnau's other films, especially like you talked about Last Laugh, how it's hardly any title cards, but there's a lot of like long takes in that movie. And there's a lot of experimental stuff he does in that film. I think one of the things he did was, I forget if it's like it's been a while since I've seen it, but it's like a flashback or something. He poured like oil or Vaseline on the camera. I mean, that's insane.
I know. It does sound insane there. But again, if it works, it works. And it did there. But in terms of that German influence, you know, a great actor like Emil Jannings, you mm-hmm. know, from those films that he did with Murnau and others, he came to Hollywood. He didn't stay more than a few years. But you know, the fact that people like that were brought over, again, we sometimes tend to think that, well, somehow, you know, that's an industry off to the side, or, you know, Hollywood was always this monolithic thing. But how receptive it was, particularly in the 20s, to European talent. And we've been talking about directors who came and stayed, but of course, you know, a number of actors as well, like Marlene Dietrich most famously, yep. but people who began in Berlin and then came to Hollywood and who made the transition. You know, Peter Lorre, you know, actors who were known, certainly mm-hmm. character actors, a lot of them.
Conrad Veidt.
And the sad thing about him actually was, he had played the somnambulist, the zombie, if you will, in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I'm becoming a zombie. he had played the somnambulist Cesare in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And you know, he, though, as an actor, was virulently anti-Nazi. So Conrad Veidt was getting out of Germany while he could get out. He came to Hollywood, and he so much hated Hitler, as did Dietrich and Fritz Lang and most of the mm-hmm. others. You know, they had a refuge, an oasis in Hollywood, among other things, to stay out of Nazi Germany. But the cruel irony for Conrad Veidt was, because of his thick German accent, he did learn to speak English. And yet he always had that pronounced German accent. And so, you know, ironically, cruelly, I think almost, what roles did Hollywood give him? He got to play Nazi officers. Think about in Casablanca, where he plays Major Strasser. He plays the German official in Casablanca who's telling you know, everybody what to do there in the Vichy French, Claude Rains and so on, what to do. But whenever I see him in a Nazi uniform, I think, God, in some ways that's cruel and unusual punishment. This man left Germany to get away from all that. And what role does he get? He plays the Nazi heavy.
Yeah, he said, I was like, I'll be down to play the performance as long as people know, like, this is what these people are. This is what the Nazis
are. I mean, I understand that. You know, let's show how evil they are, right? But the fact that, geez, can't you give me a role that doesn't involve putting on a swastika?
Can I be like one of the resistance members or something?
Yeah, exactly. Can I play in the French resistance? Or can I be a good German?
Okay, so, and then another couple of Murnau films I like to bring up. I think it's October. We're getting close to Halloween. And one of the things I always watch every Halloween is Nosferatu. And it's almost a miracle this film is even allowed to be seen, because the film is basically Dracula. And there was this lawsuit from Bram Stoker's family, and they wanted to destroy every print of that film. And I believe there was like one print remaining that was yet to be saved. And because of that, it was still released, and it's now widely available today. But just like, if that one print didn't make it, who knows what would have happened?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The problem there, and it was partly self-induced as problems go, is that when Murnau and the production team were working on Nosferatu, which came out in 1922, Bram Stoker, I believe, had died by then, but his widow was the keeper of the flame and certainly litigious. And where the Germans, to some extent, had themselves to blame, and by the Germans I mean Murnau and the creative team, it was an unauthorized version of Bram Stoker's novel, which had been an enormous hit, not only as a book, as a novel, but in a stage version or stage versions. And so as an intellectual property, it was under copyright at that point, and they didn't ask for permission. That's why in the film, it's so transparent where they changed names, and they made a few other changes. I mean,
Olaf.
Yeah. I mean, nobody's going to be fooled by any of that, right? But they tried to circumvent it by doing that. And so what happened was Stoker's widow was really, really assiduous in that she just didn't let it go. And attempts were made, like, to buy, you know, to prevent it from being made or somehow destroy it, if you will. And so it really is almost like a miracle of survival and preservation that, you know, that it did survive as a film. But again, that's where, you know, in the early years of filmmaking, 1890s through the 20s, certainly, international copyright laws were going on the books by the 1880s, actually, but they were oftentimes either difficult to enforce, or in any event, people would just ignore them oftentimes in a way that nowadays you almost wouldn't dare to. The studio lawyers would clamp down immediately. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to get permission, you got to pay somebody a royalty, whatever. Back then, it was kind of fast and loose, and a lot of American films actually even were the worst offenders. They would take European intellectual property and just do an American version without paying for the intellectual rights and so on. Because, again, a combination of things of, you know, transatlantic travel and communications weren't quite then what they are now, and also people just thinking they could do what they wanted. So it's a variation on that with Nosferatu. Not surprising in some ways that they made this unauthorized version, and then in effect, as you correctly mentioned, almost had it like destroyed. You know, almost like we might not have had it, but, you know, if she had gotten her way with, you know, trying to seize it and so on. The Bram Stoker novel is a good one. I mean, it's well written, but Nosferatu, I mean, it's an example of, you know, an even better film was made with that material.
And I think we talked about how it was almost lost. I mean, looking at a lot of, like, you look at his filmography, it's a shame, because I think like over half of his stuff has been lost. Like, they're just impossible to find. Prints have been destroyed for various reasons. And I think that's happened to a lot of directors and films in that era.
Well, it has been estimated that 90% of all silent films no longer exist.
Wow.
For the reasons you're alluding to there. In some cases, you have to realize, of course, that when these films first came out, you had first-run theaters, you had the movie palaces downtown, I mean, once you get into the studio era, and then you had the smaller theaters in the suburbs, and then you end up in the Klondike in British Columbia, the end of the line. And once films were at the end of the line, there was nothing resembling what we call the ancillary market there. They thought that films had no lasting commercial value. Once a film, essentially, once a film made its money, it had made its money, and there would be no. So oftentimes, films were just destroyed at that point or neglected because what's the point in keeping it? You know, it's made its money. And then a second reason, of course, had to do with the nitrate film stock, which was if it does, it's highly flammable. So if it doesn't go up in flames. And in fact, this film barely survived too. If it doesn't go up in flames, it may well dissolve as the chemicals melt. And then thirdly, speaking of melting chemicals, in World War II, as part of the patriotic war effort, Hollywood Studios, as part of a patriotic drive, actually took thousands of nitrate stock films off their shelves, out of their warehouses, and gave them to the federal government to be melted down for the chemical contents. Nitrate, in particular, could be put into bombs. So a lot of the old movies were put into bomb making that way. And then, you know, a fourth or a fifth and a beyond reasons, just simply the vagaries of all the things that can happen over time. Yeah. Where you know, films, and sometimes when films survive, it's like the only surviving print will be found in an archive in you know, the Czech Republic or Argentina.
Some random
or something.
Garage. Yeah.
I mean, all these wild stories, or in the case of, you know, a cache of silent films found in a filled-in swimming pool in you know, the Klondike, because that had been the end of the line. And so the films, it wouldn't be worth their while to ship the films back to Hollywood, you know. So the films ended up there, and they became fill, like fill dirt kind of fill, where, you know, to fill in a swimming pool and then covered over. And because it was essentially what I call the tundra, because it was like permafrost, that the films essentially went into a deep freeze. And that, the story I'm thinking of in particular, where, you know, dozens of hundreds of silent films were buried like that at this remote site. And then when it was finally being like excavated for a new construction project, they just found what most people had forgotten was there. That, yeah, they put fill dirt and stones and this and that, but also reels after reels after reels, all these reels of silent film that went in. In many cases now, the only surviving prints of what were thought to be lost films. And I've seen some of them, actually.
They actually work after all of that?
Well, to the extent that they, yeah, they do, but I got to qualify it there. You're going to have a lot of splotching. You're going to have missing frames.
Makes
you're not
going to
have a complete film, but you'll have at least a few minutes of a film. And in many cases, the only surviving footage of a film that was thought to be forever lost, and in some cases involving actors and directors and so on who, you know, would be known to us, whose work would be. And you maybe had read about this film, but, it, you know, thought it was forever lost. So I give that as just a quick example of remarkable things that happen actually with remarkable frequency of films just popping up that we thought were gone.
Yeah, and I wanted to get back a little bit to Nosferatu a little bit. There's two, like, films that have sort of inspired Nosferatu I want to get your opinion of. One is... go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but it just reminded me as a kind of footnote to what we were just saying about how fragile these films are and we thought they were lost. With Sunrise itself, I talked about that sound on film process, movie tone, so you get the soundtrack and sound effects actually on the film itself. So the version almost all of us watch today is what's called the movie tone print, okay, with what we mentioned. It's derived from a now fragile print that was made in 1936 for the nascent film collection at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. That was really the first museum film collection to make sure we kept these films. They didn't disappear. Thank goodness MoMA had that print, because the original 1927 camera negative was destroyed in a nitrate fire in 1937. God. See, that's exactly, that's why I usually don't interrupt, but on that point there, it's so much to the point that we almost lost this film forever because of fire.
Yeah, especially, like I said, with Murnau's, most of his work is lost because like of other things, like you said. But anyway, back to my question, a couple of films I want to get your opinion of that were sort of inspired by Nosferatu. One is the Werner Herzog remake in 1979 with Klaus Kinski. And then I believe there was a 2000 film called Shadow of the Vampire, which is like a fictional behind the scenes of Nosferatu, but this time Max Schreck, the guy who plays Nosferatu, is actually a vampire.
Exactly. And I love both those films, actually. And I've met Werner Herzog a few times, and we've talked about Nosferatu. In 1979, he released a remake which is so faithful and so loving that often shot for shot, it's exceptional how well. I mean, it's a color film and certainly a sound film, but how well he and of course Klaus Kinski, who I think was a vampire, I interviewed Klaus Kinski once, and I'll just say it was a wild interview. I'll just say it was a wild interview. Actually, I interviewed him for that remake for Nosferatu. So, but I think it's an example of one great filmmaker paying homage to another one, and it holds up as a great film. Shadow of the Vampire, I wouldn't say is a great film, but it has a great storyline, namely that, you know, Willem Dafoe and some good actors in it, and a great notion, a great premise, namely that, well, you know, Max Schreck was the actor who played Nosferatu in the 1922 original. What if he really was a vampire? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just such a great idea, you know, and I'm not making great claims for Shadow of the Vampire as a film per se, but it's such a great premise. It's a lot of fun to watch it. So there's a long trail, if you will, a long shadow there of how a great film can inspire an actual remake decades later, and then, you know, another fictional story that's riffing on that. And in other words, it's a sign of the lasting cultural influence of a film like Nosferatu, the fact that it not only does that original film, you know, keep coming back or being shown at Halloween, what have you, but these other films that are kind of piggybacked on it. And I think yet another tribute to Murnau as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll have to bring up the reason I first heard of Nosferatu was probably a lot of people my age, but I know this is a little bit random, but there was a SpongeBob SquarePants episode where there's like somebody turning off the lights in the restaurant. Like, who was turning off the lights? At the end of the episode, it's just a little cutout figure of Nosferatu. And they go, oh, Nosferatu. And so that's my very first introduction to Nosferatu.
Well, that's a great way, actually, and it furthers what we're saying. By the time it gets to SpongeBob, or, you know, like, you know you've made it if you're referenced on The Simpsons, right?
Yeah,
it's that kind of a thing. And I, you know, it's easy to, you know, smile at that or look on it as, like, pop cultural ephemera or something. But no, I think actually those are some of the most significant references, because at that point it has filtered into the general culture. When I mentioned that original Nosferatu to my college film students here at AHCC, some of them do know that film. I mean, you know, when you think about it, how many films from the 1920s realistically would you expect they had, you know, heard of or mm-hmm. much less seen? But that's one, if people have an interest in vampire lore, that's a film they know about oftentimes, or at least they've seen images from it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've seen a still photo of Max Schreck, who really is such a scary, he's such a scary vampire.
He does look like a vampire.
Well, Bela Lugosi in the Hollywood version of 1931 is menacing, but in a really suave way. You know, he's got the black cape and the good evening accent and all that. And he's somebody you would expect to meet like at an upscale dinner party, or hopefully not, but that you might meet there, or a casino or something.
Yeah.
You know, this kind of debonair guy. But in Nosferatu, where you already see a lot of rats on the ship and so on, Max Schreck's vampire is himself a rodent in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He's got rodent-like features, and he's got those incredibly long arms and long fingers and so on. And oftentimes, German Expressionism, you see him through the silhouette on the wall, which is even scarier. And actually, Dr. Caligari, to take it back to Cesare, the somnambulist, when he kills one of his victims, you see it in silhouette. You see the shadows on the wall, shadow play. And so when you have Max Schreck doing that in Nosferatu, oftentimes it's scariest when the act is completed in your imagination. Not you know, really horrific violence on screen, but you see just enough that your imagination fills in the details.
Yeah, and getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything else you want to bring up? One thing I did want to talk about is a little bit of interesting trivia. It is the one and only Oscar winner for, like, Best Creative Picture.
Thank you for saying that. That's actually the one thing I did want to add.
This is the very first Oscars.
Yeah. You know, recently when they made some changes at the Oscars, well, they tried making changes just within the last few months in terms of, we should have a whole other category for, like, most popular movies.
Yeah.
That was shot down so quickly, and thank goodness, everyone hated it.
That was stupid.
It was so stupid. Everyone, I could go on for 5 hours. Everyone thought that was a bad idea, so that was scuttled. But go back a few years earlier when they increased the number of nominees, like, for Best Picture, it could be as many as, like, 7 to 10, right? I mean, so when they made changes like that, people sometimes thought it had been like sacrosanct. Like, how can you do that? The Oscars is the Oscars. With the Academy Awards, these are fixed categories. And I don't want to get sidetracked with that argument, but some people mistakenly acted as if the Academy Awards had never made changes before.
Yeah.
And so a reminder from what you're saying in that respect. But directly back to Sunrise, it made quite an impression on the film community when it was released late in 1927. Indeed, it won 3 Academy Awards at the 1929 ceremony, which covered the years 1927 through 1928. So that first ceremony was, you know, odd in all sorts of ways. Back to the performers themselves, Janet Gaynor won the first Best Actress Oscar ever bestowed. In a move that now I think seems unusual, her Oscar acknowledged her work in three silent pictures: Sunrise, Seventh Heaven, and Street Angel.
Yeah.
And then that was one. So the three Academy Awards, one for Janet Gaynor. The second one was for the cinematography by Charles Rocher and Carl Struss. I mean, exceptional cinematography. Yeah. And now the third Academy Award is the one you're referring to. The film received a special Academy Award as the, quote, most unique and artistic production, close quote, a category that was never repeated.
Yeah. That makes sense, because what does that even mean?
It means it's a really great film, and we don't know what box to put it in.
Well, that'll be Mandy then. All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director F.W. Murnau and his 1927 film, Sunrise. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragonninjaradio.podbean.com with the category Armchair Directors. Tune into Dragon Ninja Radio to hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Mr. Giuliano, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks, I enjoyed it.
For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, leave all of this behind. Come to the city.